Hey there, everybody. Just a quick note about today's episode. It's a little different than the typical thing. It's not one of my regular episodes, not even really a Comfort Reads episode, though I do actually bring that up. But, the fact is, I read books, a lot of them science fiction, but not everything that I read is science fiction. And occasionally I read a book that I think is important, and I want to give it whatever signal boost I can with my little platform here. So that's what I'm doing today. So, like I said, it's different than a typical episode. So the book that we're going to be talking about is The Fire Is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley Jr., and the Debate Over Race in America from Princeton University Press. The author is Nicholas Bukola. Nick is a writer, a lecturer, a teacher, specializing in the area of American political thought. He is the Elizabeth and Morris Glicksman Chair of Political Science at Linfield University in McMinnville, Oregon, which isn't very far from where I live. And he was kind enough to join me for a discussion about his amazing book. So, Nick, thank you for joining me.
Happy to be here, Seth.
Yes. This is definitely a very different episode than I typically do. I was going to ask, I'm kind of filing this under comfort reads. Would you say that James Baldwin's writings are comfort reading for you?
I would say, yes and no. I mean, there's something about Baldwin's prose that is, sort of you can sit down with Baldwin and just get lost in his language. There's something about that that is on a certain level comforting. It's just sort of the ability he has to utilize language to describe the world, and describe the inner life of his characters and the people he's writing about. There's something about that I think is comforting in the sense that you kind of gain this insight into human nature and there's something about that knowledge that is, it can be comforting on one level. On another level, though, I think Baldwin is a discomfort read, and he means to be unsettling. He wants us to really probe ourselves and kind of think about the world around us. In a way that will be confronted with some pretty ugly truths. And so, I think it's sort of a tough one to answer. I love reading Baldwin, but it's also discomforting.
Right. Well, and as a professor of political science too, right? Reading someone like Baldwin is kind of work as well, especially when in the context of a book.
Yeah. And Baldwin is somebody who, when I was first, sort of reading him seriously, it was really challenging for me because my background is in political theory, and political theorists, in the world of political science, tend to be the most, kind of literature adjacent, and able to engage fiction in a lot of interesting ways. But, Baldwin definitely confronted me with a lot of challenges. I mean, he's thinking about the world in such a different way. I'm sort of used to political theory as such of being, these big questions about politics and these kind of systematic answers to those questions from these great, political philosophers. And Baldwin is addressing those questions, but he's just doing it in this really radically different way. And so it was really challenging, but it was eye-opening. I mean, Baldwin really changed the way I see the world.
Right. Well, so let's talk about kind of the origins of the book. And for that, I think it's important to find out, how did you discover James Baldwin? I don't know if you're like me where, I discovered him earlier this year for the first time, which on one hand, I kind of blame the education system because, we had our one tiny little unit on the civil rights movement in 1988 in U.S. history in high school. And I don't remember if his name was mentioned, but he's not someone that I've sought out. And I deeply regret that now that I've found him. But I'm curious, how long have you known about him?
Yeah. Baldwin is somebody who, I'm in the same boat with you. I mean, growing up in high school and that sort of thing, I don't think I was exposed to any James Baldwin. When I was in college, I think probably in one of my sort of, kind of introductory composition classes, I read Sonny's Blues, one of his great short stories. And, that had an impact, but I really hadn't really read Baldwin seriously until several years ago. I was invited to write an essay on Baldwin. And it was kind of by accident. I got the invitation from Sue McWilliams, who's a political theorist at Pomona College. And I confessed to Sue at the time, I said, I really don't know Baldwin all that well. I'd been working mostly on the political thought of Frederick Douglass. And there are various reasons that this invitation came about. So I said to Sue, I don't really know Baldwin very well. And I'm not sure I'm the right fit to contribute to this book about Baldwin. And right. She said, you know, you have 2 years to work on the essay. So you have a year to read James Baldwin and a year to write the essay. And so I thought, okay, that sounds good. And I'd read enough Baldwin at that point to know that this was somebody I wanted to spend some time with. And so that invitation led to me going down the rabbit hole of James Baldwin videos on YouTube. And then I saw this debate with William F. Buckley. And I was just transfixed by this moment of these two leading public intellectuals, you know, James Baldwin being kind of one of the key, you know, sort of figures in the civil rights revolution, Buckley being, you know, a founding father of American conservatism on this international stage. And so I ended up using that debate as kind of my framing device in the essay. And as I worked on the essay, I kept thinking to myself, there's a book in here. Somebody's got to write this book. And over time I, you know, gained the confidence to be the one to write the book. And then the process of figuring out what the book would look like and how I would sort of fill out the backstory of the debate and so on, and ended up being the kind of path I took to the book, The Fire Is Upon Us, as it exists now in the world.
Nice. Did you know it was going to be quite as big as it is?
No, I didn't. And, you know, the first thing I did when I was really serious about the book project was I wanted to know the basic story of how they got there that night, because there had been next to nothing written about that. And one of the good things about, you know, the timing of this was that this was about, you know, 2015 or so. And so 50 years on, the students who hosted them, the Cambridge Union, it's a, you know, undergraduate debating society, they were, you know, many of those folks were still alive. So I was able to, my students at Linfield University and I were able to track down some of the students who actually hosted the debate 50 plus years ago. And so I was able to interview a number of those students, and they were able to tell me the kind of story of how this night happened. And so I had one idea for the book, which would really be really focused on the debate itself, you know, kind of a shorter book that would capture this night, this big night at Cambridge. And so I built out that story. But then the more research I did, and, you know, digging into the archives first of William F. Buckley, which are vast at Yale University, he has this very extensive archive there. And then the Baldwin Archive eventually opened in 2017 when I was in the midst of working on the book. I knew that there was this kind of, this was a much longer story, really. The story of Baldwin v. Buckley that night is this climactic moment. But really the story that is, I think, in some ways more important is the story leading up to that night. So that Baldwin and Buckley are born about a year apart from each other. So what I try to do is tell the story of, you know, the kind of these two individuals, a little bit about their kind of childhood and upbringing, and then really picking up in the late 40s and early 50s when they're arriving on the intellectual scene, kind of telling the story of how these two individuals viewed the world and how their experiences shaped how they viewed the world, and really thinking in slow motion as they evolve through the, you know, through the 50s into the 60s and sort of leading up to this night when they clash. And so that's how it ended up being this big book, but I think that was the right way to do it. You know, I really think that is, you know, I'm glad I made that choice because I think it paid off in the end.
Yeah, it really does add a lot of color to what's going on in that debate. And I mean, it's a similar story for me where, you know, this year of all years with all the upheaval and everything, like all of a sudden, like the scales fell from my eyes and I went, wait a second, why haven't I like checked into Black history? Mm-hmm. Like why have I always considered, well, that's not my history. Mm-hmm. Like, but it's American history. So, mm-hmm. you know, it absolutely affects everyone in America. And I think in June or so, somewhere along there, a suggested video came up on YouTube and it was just titled James Baldwin Pin Drop Speech. And it was his portion of the Cambridge Union debate. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I was transfixed by it. And I think I watched it twice a day for the next week, just listening to his portion of it. You know, I didn't for some reason want to listen to Buckley's over and over, but just the language that Baldwin brings to bear and the way he speaks. I mean, obviously, I'm not the only person to have that reaction to it. Everyone there that night seemed to have that reaction. But then I found later on a fuller recording of the entire debate with all of the Cambridge student participation as well. Right. But I didn't have any idea until I read your book just how packed that place was. You know, I didn't know what it normally looked like. Mm-hmm. And I think I found found a lecture or a talk that you gave a while back mm-hmm. where you had in the slideshow, you showed like, here's what this space looks like normally.
Right.
And I went, wow, okay, there's a floor there. Who knew? Because that's how full it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess we haven't really talked about what the debate is. And so for anyone who doesn't know that, why don't you introduce that?
Yeah. So the scene was February 18th, 1965. And just to put that in, you know, brief historical context, that was right in the midst of the Selma campaign. So we're kind of at the high tide of the civil rights, that phase of the civil rights revolution. The Selma was, you know, the streets of Selma were filled with folks, you know, fighting for voting rights, among other things. And so Baldwin and Buckley end up at the Cambridge Union at the, you know, in England at the, on the campus, the beautiful, you know, streets of Cambridge, England, the University of Cambridge. The Cambridge Union had just marked its 150th anniversary. It's their claim is that they're the world's oldest debating society, certainly one of the most prestigious debating societies. They would say the most prestigious. Oxford would have, you know, would beg to differ. But I side with the Cambridge guys. Right. But yeah, so you have this kind of moment in, it's not just a, you know, the story of the civil rights revolution is, of course, an international story. And so this moment at the high tide of the civil rights movement, you have Baldwin and Buckley invited to, as you said, Seth, a student debating society, right? The students are the primary, you know, stars of the show at the Cambridge Union. But for many years leading up to this night, they had invited guests of honor. So you'd have members of parliament come. Theodore Roosevelt had spoken at the Cambridge Union. A lot of distinguished people had come to speak to issues of importance that they have had some authority to speak about. And so Baldwin ends up there that night, actually as a result of a publicity tour for the paperback release of his third novel, Another Country. And in the midst of, when they get that sort of opportunity to bring James Baldwin to campus, they have to find, it's because it's a debating society, they say, well, we can't host you just for a book event. We will host you for a debate. And right. So they come up with this motion, which the motion was the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro. That was the way the Cambridge Union, using the, you know, the terminology of the day, that's the motion they came up with. And William F. Buckley at that time wasn't yet internationally famous. He was certainly famous in the United States, second only to Barry Goldwater as a kind of face of the American conservative movement. Yeah. One of the students had happened to have met Buckley 2 years prior and knew enough about him to know that he would be perfect to play this role opposite James Baldwin debating that motion. And so Buckley ends up, it all comes together in just a matter of weeks in early 1965. They pull this debate together and then the BBC is there to record it. And as you said, I mean, that space, which is not actually that large of a space if you go visit it in person, is just packed with 700 students in the debating hall itself. And then there's all these other rooms on the union premises, and those rooms were also packed. There's a bar and there's various dining rooms, and they had closed, you know, circuit television so the students could watch who couldn't make it in. There were more students lined up outside who wanted to get in. So it was just this kind of event. And it was, of course, broadcast not only in the UK, but also internationally, broadcast in the US, broadcast in Canada, and then has had this life, you know, since it, you know, it's come back to life in the last 10 years or so, where it's sort of been digitized and put on YouTube. And now it's sort of this thing, as you said, that kind of goes viral on occasion. And Baldwin is definitely having this moment when a lot of people who didn't know him before are getting to know him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a very fortunate thing, too, with I know the BBC's practices for archiving television programs. You know, they typically just take the tape out and go, OK, well, I guess we can record something else over that now. So it's very fortunate for us that it still exists.
Yeah, that's one of the things that when working on this project, it was, you know, it was just kind of, there was sort of moments of really great joy and moments of frustration where, I mean, Baldwin and Buckley, as far as, you know, at least I was able to discover, only met twice, this time in February at the Cambridge Union, and they met about 3 months later in New York on a television program called The Open End. And that latter encounter is precisely what you just described happened to that encounter. The practice of that show at the time was to record and then tape over as soon as they needed more tape. And so the Museum of Television is looking for a copy of that second Buckley v. Baldwin encounter. But yeah, it's one of these great things that, you know, that there are folks who care enough about history to keep on, you know, hang on to these things. And fortunately for me, as I worked on the book, the Cambridge Union itself kept audio recordings of these debates. And the Buckley v. Baldwin audio recording was apparently lost in a fire. That was what the Cambridge Union reported to me on several occasions. And so one of the students happened to have requested a copy of that debate before, when he was a student there. And so he had this old reel-to-reel audio in his attic. And I, when I interviewed all these Cambridge students, you know, who, these guys are in their 70s, I would ask each of them, because we knew, but for various reasons, I knew that the BBC recording was edited down. There were things missing from, right. from that. And so, yeah, one of these students, Adrian Vincent, I'll be forever grateful to Adrian. He said, I have the audio recording in my attic. And so he sent it across the pond to me in Portland, and I took it to various digital, you know, audio people here, and finally found one that could actually make something of it and digitize it. And so that's available for people to listen to on the audiobook as well for The Fires Upon Us.
Oh, awesome. So that replaces the transcript?
Yeah. And so then we did a transcript based on that audio recording. So what you end up getting in the full recording is Baldwin's speech, the BBC left intact. I mean, there was nowhere for them to cut. Buckley actually speaks for longer than Baldwin, but Baldwin speaks for 24 minutes. Buckley speaks for 29. The BBC ended up editing down Buckley's speech quite a bit. And one of the things that is taken out that I think is really valuable is the students at the Cambridge Union, like in the House of Commons, the practice was they could stand up and be acknowledged by the speaker for a question or point of information. And no one stood up during Baldwin's speech. I say in the book, it would have been kind of profane to do that because he was delivering this sermon. Many students stood up during the Buckley speech. And so there are a number of those questions that are picked up in the audio recording that you don't get to see in the BBC recording, which I think are well worth checking out.
I think the BBC recording has I think there was an American professor there who stood up and said, well, perhaps you should let them vote, which then triggers Buckley going into his famous, it's not that the black people aren't voting, it's that too many white people are voting. We don't need to expand the franchise to black people. We need to restrict it to, you know, only the correct white people, which.
Yeah.
yeah. And nobody thinks that way anymore, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you could see, you know, why the BBC kept that in. That was that was a moment in the debate where Buckley, in his characteristic way, you know, did this, you know, thing where somebody confronts him with a very serious point and he uses humor in some ways. Well, it seemed like humor to them that he, you know, he uses humor to deflate situations. He did that with a number of the questions. With that one, although they laugh, he's being absolutely serious. He had been arguing that for a long time and he believed that the answer to the problems in the United States were not more democracy, but less democracy. That was Buckley's position, no doubt about it.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I think you and I have similar backgrounds. We grew up pretty conservative. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, the landslide for Reagan and my parents being thrilled about that. And you know, I knew who Buckley was, but, you know, I didn't know anything about him. And I certainly didn't think that the kind of conservative impulse that was on display in the 80s, that when you bumped it back 15 years, then you would have conservatives arguing for segregation. That never would have entered my mind. And when you kind of do that and you look at where did this pattern of thought come from and what does it imply, it really makes you kind of reevaluate everything that you've built out from there.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned earlier, Seth, with the, you know, the kind of gaps in our education growing up and, you know, confronting figures like Baldwin, I mean, this is another point about how we teach history, right? We don't really, there's so much that we don't know about American history. And yeah, I think that certainly, you know, there's a reason for that, right? I mean, there's a kind of mythology, there's a kind of story that we tell about our political history that, you know, in many instances is meant to kind of make us feel comfortable with that history. And there's a lot of reasons why societies tend to do that. I think we're in this moment right now where we're confronting that in a more serious way and thinking through. And I think there are changes, but there's a lot that we just don't know. And I will, you know, confess also, as I say in the, you know, my notes at the end of the book, I mean, there's a lot of ways in which so much of what I learned and what sort of my understanding of these things was changed as a result of working on this book. I mean, I think that Buckley was somebody who was not, he was certainly on my radar for a long time, but as a sort of college student who thought of himself as a kind of libertarian conservative type, you know, spending some time in Washington, D.C. in the kind of circle, in a lot of circles where Buckley was absolutely lionized as this hero. Right. And sort of still for a generation, multiple generations of young conservatives wanted to be like William F. Buckley with that kind of style and that panache and the way he presented his ideas. And so, yeah, there's a lot that, you know, and my eyes were opened in a lot of different ways to this history. And although Buckley is just one figure, he's a really important figure, you know, as I argue, and many others have argued in the book, he really plays an outsized role in the shaping of the American conservative movement. So I try not to make, you know, sort of really bold causal claims about William F. Buckley did X and therefore Y. But I do think, you know, thinking through what Buckley was doing and how he was responding to events in the civil rights movement, doing that in kind of some depth and slow motion, I think was, you know, really a worthwhile thing. And I think it's the kind of, I like doing political history that way. There's something about really sitting with a particular figure and thinking through, trying to see the world through their eyes and understand how they came to take certain positions. I think there's something about that that can really help us understand where we are today.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, when I first watched this, I watched, like I said, the Baldwin side of it over and over. And then I finally watched the entire debate. And I commented to my wife, I'm like, Buckley is like Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life. He's coming off as like a 1940s movie villain who's, you know, sitting on top of a stack of cash, you know, and looking down on the little people. That's even his posture in the debate. I saw that way. And part of it's just because I didn't agree with anything he was saying. It's interesting, the parallels between his thought and the thoughts that he put out during that debate and some of the rhetoric that you see still today, because, you know, he accused Baldwin of wanting to break down the foundations of American society, you know, and disband the police. And I'm like, okay, there's some of that kind of thought going on now, and certainly accusations about disbanding versus defunding police, right? You have people conflating the two ideas. The vilifying of riots, you know, riots are unacceptable in pursuit of freedom to Buckley, right? And there's a lot of people still today who are saying that. Police brutality, it's just a few bad apples, right? And this, I think you brought up in one of the talks that I saw you give about the, and it's in the book as well, right? The difference between where Buckley would say, well, where white people are doing bad things is just a few individuals, but here is the entire black community. If there's anything systemic wrong, it's in the black community, not in white people. Mm-hmm. And so kind of that individual versus community dichotomy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, you hit a number of important points there, Seth. I mean, this is, you know, when you look at the debate and you see the way Buckley is defending his position, and you see the way Baldwin is responding. I mean, in some ways, we there's kind of, you can just take their comments and we could put them on any of our cable news shows. And, you know, it's certainly on the Buckley side, as you said, there's so many ways we're seeing these arguments play out again, the same kind of rhetoric, the same kind of framing. And yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to, you know, when we think about the way Buckley responded to Baldwin, and I try to, you know, lay out in some detail in the book, you know, when Buckley speaks second, right? So Baldwin gives his speech, right. Buckley gives his speech, and, you know, there's so many ways in which seems obvious when one watches the debate that Buckley really wasn't listening to Baldwin. I mean, right. he has the approach that he wants to take, and he takes it. And part of what he does, as you said, is that he tries to sort of frame Baldwin as this dangerous radical hellbent on overthrowing Western civilization, hellbent on overthrowing the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and Christianity and Plato and Socrates and Aristotle and so on. And then that's part of the argument. And then, as you said, the other part of it is to really kind of make this claim, as you said, to sort of anything he can do to draw our attention away from systemic racism, from structural inequality, and draw our attention to the idea that, yes, there are individual racists out there, and they need to be dealt with. But then also making this kind of collective claim that there are failures, as Buckley puts it, failures in the Negro community. That's a quote from the debate that are also to blame. That rhetoric is absolutely, you know, with us today. And Baldwin, I mean, one of the things Baldwin confronted that sort of thing all of the time. He was engaged in debate or discussion. And, you know, I think Baldwin has this really, you know, profound and nuanced way of of thinking through these questions. And he really, one of the terms that he uses a lot, that I think is kind of overused now in a lot of different contexts, but it really meant a lot to Baldwin, was the term demoralization. I remember one interview Baldwin gave in 1963 when essentially this white interviewer down in Florida actually says to Baldwin, he basically says something like what, very similar to what Buckley says. He says, aren't black people a little bit too lethargic, is the word this reporter uses of Baldwin. And Baldwin says, I haven't met a great many, black people who are lethargic, but I have met a number who are demoralized. And those are two different things. Right. And I think he captures this beautifully in the speech, right? Baldwin describes, he tries to get the students to sort of just imagine what it is like, right, to grow up in any one of the country's ghettos, right? And he talks about the millions of details of every day that indicate to you that your life does not matter quite as much, and that no matter what you do, no matter how hard you study, no matter how many pennies you save, the game is still rigged against you. Baldwin wants people to sort of think about what that must be like for the individual. And then not only that, but think about what it's like for the individual as that individual gets old enough to have kids, and think about, do I have faith that this country will deliver on those promises for my kids? And that idea, I think, is so powerful. And in this sort of idea of the American dream, which is the heart of the debate, Baldwin really, is trying in this kind of prophetic role that he plays to get us to think deeply about what our promises are and the ways in which we've fallen short on those promises, and what our responsibility is in terms of closing that gap.
Yeah, that moment where he says, now you're 30 and you're seeing these happen to your children, and you realize that nothing you've done and perhaps nothing you can do will rescue them from it.
Yeah, that's it right there. That's the line. That's the line. I love it when people can quote the Baldwin speech from memory, Seth. You're doing good work.
Oh yeah, yeah. It kind of has been just rolling around in my head for months. I do love though that Baldwin is also very empathetic to the white people that are affected by the doctrine of white supremacy, and they don't realize it, right? And he says at some point, what's he say? What's happening in the poor person's mind is that they've been raised to believe and now hopelessly believe, right, that they are superior simply because they're white. And it's a terrible thing to do to a person. And that in some ways, that kind of internalization of white supremacy for white people is in some ways worse than the violence that's perpetrated. Now, I'm not sure I can agree with that, but it's just a measure of kind of a difference between the way Buckley is this kind of very cold and analytical person, and Baldwin is this very, we need each other to overcome this. And he seems to always have hope. Even in some of the interviews that I saw later in his life in the 80s, he would say, look, I can't be a pessimist about this. I have to believe that we can overcome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that the kind of radical empathy that Baldwin shows, is really remarkable. I mean, that line that he uses that you refer to in the speech, is just one of those moments when you just think to yourself, wow. I mean, the fact that he could, he says, right, he gives the example of Sheriff Jim Clark, who in that moment is, people are seeing him on television and on, newspapers, using his cattle prod, right? Brandishing his cattle prod in the streets of Alabama. And Baldwin basically wants to draw our attention to the ways in which the doctrine of white supremacy has victims that are obvious, the sort of, what he calls the subjugated, the people who are the direct targets of the doctrine. But Baldwin also wants to draw our attention to the ways in which the subjugators, those who are the would-be beneficiaries of white supremacy, are also its victims. And he says in that line you described, he says, when you see Jim Clark using his cattle prod, what's happening to his victim is ghastly, but in some ways, what's happening to Jim Clark is much, much worse. And I think that's where, when he says in some ways, right, I think that's important. Yeah. And so Baldwin's drawing our attention to the ways in which, Jim Clark, this guy, who's obviously this extreme example of something that, is manifest in the world in all sorts of less obvious ways, is somebody who's entire sense of self, his entire sense of value in the world is bound up in this delusion of white supremacy, and that his role in the world, the way he conceives of his role in the world, is as a guardian of that doctrine. And I think we see, this is something I've been thinking about this week with the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. you know, is just kind of another moment, right, to see this manifest itself. I've been watching a lot of folks on the right, you know, kind of celebrating with glee the passing of Ginsburg and sort of feeling like this is a moment in which they can advance their agenda and so on and so forth. And I found myself thinking about Baldwin and that idea of radical empathy, because I can't help but get angry when I see some of the reactions that I'm seeing right now. And at the same time, I also feel what Baldwin would say is that I think there's room for anger and there's justified anger, but there's also there's room for sadness, right, and pain, and recognizing, you know, as I think about some of these folks who their identity is so wrapped up not only in white supremacy, but in, you know, that sort of doctrine of white supremacy manifesting itself in, you know, sort of other political causes, you know, whether it's clinging too tightly to their guns as a conception of who they are, whatever it is, that in some ways, Baldwin is always asking us what lies beneath all that, right? What is it that's causing us to construct our identities in one way or another? And Baldwin is constantly, you know, asking us to really engage in the kind of introspection that would allow us to see the falseness, you know, of the identities we've constructed for ourselves. And so, I mean, there's a lot there, right? But I think there is a kind of radical empathy that Baldwin presents us with that's really important. I'm not always sure how to, you know, use that empathy in the world as it exists now and maybe an even more polarized setting. But it's an important thing. And then at the same time, just one last point on this is that Baldwin is, you know, simultaneously has this kind of radical empathy, but also a kind of radical confrontation, you know, that's necessary. And so Baldwin, when he confronts somebody like Buckley, and I talk about other encounters he has in his life with people like James Jackson Kilpatrick, a leading, you know, segregationist, Baldwin, you know, he does feel an obligation. He does see a difference between people like Buckley and Kilpatrick on the one hand and people like Sheriff Jim Clark on the other, and just ordinary white folks who are kind of clinging to white supremacy. But Baldwin says there's something about Buckley and Kilpatrick that is in many ways more nefarious because they know what they're doing. People like Jim Clark are kind of caught up in webs of delusion that they don't really understand. Buckley and Kilpatrick are in some ways weaving those webs to advance agendas that have nothing to do with the well-being of Jim Clark or anybody like him, right? They have to do with other things. So I think that's another really important point to make about Baldwin's approach.
Yeah, and definitely there is that angle of confrontation there too, because there's that the climactic moment, right? The I picked the cotton, which just gives me chills every time when he says that. And, I mean, and that's where the pin drop is, right? Where he says that the Southern oligarchy is, you know, a result of the exploitation of my people and the, you know, the murder of my people and the violation of my women. And no one can object to that. It's a matter of historical record. And it's just like, it's just the mic drop moment to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that series, that line, you know, that series of lines when Baldwin says, you know, I mean this literally, I picked the cotton, I built the roads, that moment. And I think we can, and this is what just another, you know, sort of example for listeners to think about in terms of coming to terms with our history. Baldwin is always saying, come to terms with your history. That is the foundation of everything else. And so when he's doing that with this kind of very, you know, personalized account, he's trying to sort of get us to accept this point that he made again and again. History is present in all we do, right? History, he says, we are trapped in history and history is trapped in us. And so if you think about any of these issues we're talking about, policing, you know, mass incarceration, voting rights, discrimination in terms of our residential lives. I mean, there is a deep history there that we as a country have not confronted. And that is what Baldwin is calling on us to do. That is the first step, coming to terms, accepting, right, what we've done, and then trying to figure out what our responsibility is going forward. And Baldwin, just one point on this I think is really important, is Baldwin says, we have to come to terms with this history, not because we want to make people feel guilty. Baldwin said, I don't have time for your guilt. What I need is your responsibility, right? You are a human being, and you are responsible as a result of that fact alone. And that's, I think, going back to your point about Baldwin's hope. Baldwin, you know, his hope undergoes a lot of, you know, his hope is sort of in the period when we see him in 1965, he's, you know, his hope might be at a high point, but we see in the years after that, his hope declines in various ways. I mean, most, you know, Malcolm X is killed 3 days after the debate with Buckley. Martin Luther King, of course, is killed in 1968. There's all sorts of other reasons why Baldwin is kind of losing hope. But he maintains some hope because he says, I still, you know, hang on to the idea that human beings can be better than they are, right? He says in 68 that, you know, I have to, you know, sort of human beings are simultaneously capable of miraculous behavior, and they're also so capable of disastrous behavior. And so he really wants us to say, as long as we're alive, we have to believe we can be better than we are. And even if we don't look around us and say, man, I don't think that this world is going to get all that much better for all of us, we have to hang on to the idea that maybe there's things we can do now to make it better, you know, for the next generation. That's a conclusion Baldwin reaches. And I think it's a really difficult thing to confront. I mean, I think in 1963, he says it beautifully in this letter to his nephew that's published in The Fire Next Time, is one of his most famous books. He says, you know, the purpose of the essay was to celebrate, you know, 100 years of emancipation.
100 years too early.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He says 100 years too early. So I've been thinking a lot lately about the year 2063, right? I mean, what can we do as a society by 2063? Of course, there's things we need to do much more urgently, but what, you know, thinking, you know, sort of about our horizons, you know, where are we going to be in 2063? Can we say that Baldwin, when he said, you know, 100 years too soon, you know, what can we say about that statement? I've been thinking a lot about that statement, and it's sort of simultaneously inspiring and haunting.
See, now you're moving into science fiction there.
Exactly.
Projecting out to 2063.
Right. Well, no, that's right. And you do have, you know, in terms of, you know, the connecting to, you know, what a lot of your listeners, you know, care a lot about, you know, this sort of this wonderful, you know, kind of genre of Afrofuturism, right, that is in part, you know, I think meant to, and this is something where I think it connects to Baldwin very, you know, very beautifully, although not a science fiction writer himself. He's somebody who I think is someone who, when we're thinking about what capacities as human beings we really need to begin the world anew, the capacity of imagination is absolutely crucial. We have to imagine a world that's different from the one that we have. And so absolutely, I think imagination is crucial. And I know imagination is central to the genre of science fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, so we've been talking about the book for a while and, you know, about the debate as well. And so in case it wasn't clear to my listeners, I highly recommend this book. It's fantastic. Everybody should pick it up. But also, you know, I want to encourage people to check out James Baldwin if they haven't read him. And of course, you know, check out the Cambridge Union debate. That's great. But where would you say people should start with his writings?
Yeah, that's a great question, Seth. And I've been getting this question a lot, and it makes me so happy, you know, when I go out and give it, you know, back in the days when I was going out and giving talks, and now I'm doing a lot of Zoom talks all over the place, and people ask, you know, where should they start with Baldwin? If I can get more people to read James Baldwin as real to this, then it's all worth it. And so what I would say to folks is two things. I mean, one is that Baldwin's fiction, it's a great way in. So Goatell on the Mountain, his first novel, is a kind of semi-autobiographical novel about a family much like his own, you know, in Harlem. And I think it's accessible and it's a great way in. Giovanni's Room, his second novel, is a very different kind of novel. It's about a love affair between a young American, David, and an Italian bartender named Giovanni. Very controversial novel, 1956. Right. When it was published. And so that's another good way in. But with his nonfiction, I mean, Baldwin's fiction is great, but I think that a lot of scholars argue, and I think I would generally agree. I mean, Baldwin, his most enduring legacy, I think, is as an essayist. Baldwin, many have argued, was, you know, is sort of in this tradition of great American essayists, you know, with Emerson and others, as just sort of somebody who sort of really mastered the art of the essay. And so what I tell people, though, I think that one thing that's is an obstacle for folks as they pick up James Baldwin as an essayist, is if they pick up his first essay collection, Notes of a Native Son, what's tricky about that book is part one is literary criticism. So it's a little bit odd if you pick it up, and there's a little autobiographical notes he does in the beginning, which are just a few pages, which are worth reading. But then if you dive into part one, you're like, okay, he's talking about a bunch of other books that maybe I haven't read in a while.
And a movie.
Right? So what I recommend to people is that they read the autobiographical notes, but or just start with the essay Notes of a Native Son, which is the beginning of part two, because that's an essay in which Baldwin reflects on his, mostly his relationship with his father, but it gives you a kind of nice a sense of who he is, kind of how he, you know, came to be who he is. And so I think that's a great place to start. And then the essays in the rest of the essays in that part two, I think are great as well. And then also just, you know, The Fire Next Time, which is really just this little book, which is published in 1963 as a book, but it consists of two essays that Baldwin published late in 1962. I think it's a great way to start. I would say Notes of a Native Son, though, that essay is really where I think it's much more accessible. Fire Next Time can be a little overwhelming because there's so much going on in there. So I think I'd recommend to folks, they start with Notes of a Native Son, part two, and kind of work their way from there and read a little bit of the fiction. And once they get in, I think it's really hard to get out, and you don't want to get out because Baldwin's such a great writer.
Yeah. Yeah. I read The Fire Next Time not long after finding the debate. I bought the book and read it. And it's the kind of thing you can read in an afternoon pretty easily. And I thought, okay, I want to read this again. And so I checked, and the Washington County Library had a digital audiobook of it. And I needed to mow the lawn, so I downloaded that audiobook. It's read by Jesse L. Martin, so it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And put that into my brain while I was mowing the lawn. That was really cool. I read Notes of a Native Son just last week. And like you said, the first book of it, right? The first part of it, you know, he's talking about Uncle Tom's Cabin and I think Native Son, right? There's a book called Native Son. And then Carmen Jones, the movie. And so my wife and I actually watched the movie.
Oh, okay.
Because I wanted the context. I wanted to know, you know, what's he talking about here? But yeah, I think the impact of those essays is a little less on the modern reader.
Yeah. And I think that people should know that, you know, I think one of the reasons, you know, Baldwin in that period, right, in the late 40s, you know, you have to, it's so amazing to think about. In the late 40s, he's publishing those first pieces. You know, he's only like 24 years old, right? So he's essentially what you're seeing him work out there, which I think is the kind of thing that folks who they get to know Baldwin might want to return to later, is, you know, he's working out what does it mean. He says, my goal is to be an honest man and a good writer. So he's really trying to figure out what does it mean to be a good writer? What does it mean to be engaged in this artistic enterprise? And so that literary criticism, the film criticism, is Baldwin trying to define for himself what it means to be an artist. And one thing I would also recommend, and this is another way into Baldwin, is that, you know, the second essay collection, Nobody Knows My Name, which, you know, is published a few years later, for folks, you know, who are kind of interested in, you know, beyond sort of the Baldwin as a kind of essayist about the, you know, American racial issues and so on. I really like, you know, Nobody Knows My Name has some really amazing pieces where Baldwin describing his first journey to the American South that are classics. But he also has pieces in there that are really about, you know, kind of what he takes to be the role of the artist in society. And I always tell people that is important not only for artists to kind of grapple with Baldwin's reflections on that, but also I think everything he has to say about the artist is meant to also be a kind of indication that applies to everyone. Like what Baldwin kind of grappling with what it means to live a good life, and Baldwin like really thinking through the meaning of love, you know, and I think love is kind of this idea that's at the core of Baldwin's philosophy that comes through in some of those essays that he's publishing in the late 50s and early 60s, especially. And Baldwin is somebody who thinks that one of our big problems is our inability to love ourselves as individuals. And Baldwin sort of has this conception of love, which is really about confrontation. It's about, you know, confronting yourself and thinking about the ways in which you've constructed a false identity in order to feel safe. And he says loving another person is also about confrontation. Love is a battle. Love is a war. Love is a growing up. And he says a lover at his best helps the beloved understand himself, and with that revelation makes freedom real. And so there's something about that is so crucial to Baldwin's philosophy. And there's all sorts of pieces. There's the collected essays, you know, that kind of have, you know, everything, almost all the nonfiction Baldwin published. And then there's actually a second volume called The Uncollected Essays. It's the Cross of Redemption, that everyone should pick up as well, because it has sort of other nonfiction that Baldwin published over the years that wasn't included in his first collected essays. So yeah, there's so much there. And once you dip in to the Baldwin, works, I think that there's something for everybody. I mean, you'll find some things will work better for other, than others. Yeah. But there's just so much there. He just was such a brilliant writer and thinker. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he really can marshal the English language very effectively. I also picked up, I found a cheap copy of Going to Meet the Man, which is a collection of stories. And because I wanted to read some of his fiction, because I hadn't yet. But I think I would like to pick up Go Tell It on the Mountain.
Yeah. Yeah. Go Tell on the Mountain is a great, thing to read alongside of the Notes of the Native Son essay, because you have this character, Gabriel, which is, loosely based on Baldwin's stepfather, right. David. And you just have these ways in which, Baldwin uses so many of those characters in the novel as, these kind of composites that you see a little bit of him and various characters in the novel. And also you just the way he, so beautifully, in the Go Tell on the Mountain and Giovanni's Room seem like such radically different stories, in terms of the sort of the setting, the characters and so on. But you kind of get a sense once you get to know Baldwin a little bit of how he's really, working out through these characters, these big philosophical questions that are relevant to all of our lives. They're radically different novels, but they're both brilliant in their own way. And then Another Country, his third novel, which we haven't talked about, which is published in 1962. I don't recommend it as a place to start with Baldwin's fiction, because it is a sprawling, complicated novel that, is a little bit less accessible for a lot of, it was for me at least, I could say. His fiction is also great. And in both the fiction and nonfiction, Baldwin's always engaged in this really, important enterprise of trying to see the world through the eyes of others and help his readers do the same. He thinks that's kind of crucial to our moral lives, is being able to imagine the world through the eyes of others. And so that's what he's doing. And I think he does it beautifully.
Is there anybody, kind of asking you to speculate or comment on authors of today, is there anybody who's picked up, what Baldwin was doing and is doing it as effectively now?
I've gotten this question a lot, and it's tough, right? And this is something that, reading all these interviews with Baldwin, one thing I learned from him is, be careful when naming names, right? or not naming names. But no, I do. There's a few, a few things that I've just read recently that I think, kind of capture a lot of what Baldwin was doing so beautifully. I mean, one of the things Baldwin does that I think is not necessarily unique to him, but it's a sort of this thing that he did so beautifully, was he would mix the autobiographical with the universal, right? I mean, there's a writer, who calls it, if it was a, if he was an athlete and we wanted to sort of, it was like his move, right? She calls it the Jimmy, right? The Jimmy would be, to go from the particular to the universal and then back to the particular. And so I think Baldwin did that so beautifully. And so, I mean, there's so many folks who I think are doing that really well, in our own time. Kiese Lehman is one person who's done that really well. Imani Perry has a beautiful, I mean, she's done this in a variety of her works, the work Breathe, but also she has a book about Lorraine Hansberry in which she's kind of thinking with Lorraine Hansberry and trying to, somebody who's really important in Baldwin's life and drawing on her own, autobiography. Eddie Glaude, who has a New York Times bestselling book about Baldwin out there right now called Begin Again, which is kind of picks up in a lot of ways where my book leaves off. I kind of more or less wrap up the narrative in 65, and Eddie's really writing about late Baldwin. And so Eddie does a really beautiful job kind of thinking about history, but also bringing us into the present and connecting it to his own life. Natasha Trethway has a beautiful book, Memorial Drive, out right now. That's, that I think is definitely worth checking out. I could go on. And I think also another thing to check out is, there's a lot of this moment, right, as we're thinking we are in, we should always be in a moment of reckoning, with our history, but we're certainly in a moment where the broader culture is reckoning with these issues. There's all sorts of writers emerging, in some cases, writers being, kind of quote unquote discovered, who are really, you know, articulating in beautiful, powerful language, you know, their perceptions of the world as they're living through this extraordinary moment. And I think that's what, you know, Baldwin, you know, sort of those folks are carrying on the spirit of Baldwin, right? Because Baldwin wants us to find those voices that will help us make sense of the world as it's changing and try help us, you know, again, make sense of what our responsibilities are in helping, you know, bring about change toward justice.
Nice. I think that's a good place to leave it. So how can people find you?
Oh, wow. I have a website, you know, www.nicholasbucola.com. I'm doing all sorts of events on Zoom, you know, for various. So I actually have a conversation about the fires upon us tomorrow, Thursday, September 24th, which would have been in Memphis. I'm really sad I'm not going to actually be in Memphis, but I'll be chatting with folks at the University of Memphis about the book. And then a bunch of other events and all that stuff is on Zoom. And so it's one thing that's fortunate about that is it gives, you know, accessibility to a lot of folks who wouldn't otherwise be able to find me. I'm also on Twitter. I'm not great at Twitter, but I'm trying. So I'm Bucola_Nick is my Twitter handle. But yeah, folks, check out the website. They can find a bunch of additional stuff about the book and yeah, get a sense of what I'm up to. And yeah, definitely love to hear from readers, you know, as they you know, interact with the book. So I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, Seth. It's been fun.
No, it was one of those things where I'm like, you know what, if I don't send the message, then there's no chance that he comes on the show. So I thought, I'm just going to go up to the website and fill out the contact form and see what happens. And so I was on vacation actually at the time. And I told my wife, I'm like, oh, he's going to come on the show now.
Now I don't know what to do.
So I guess I got to finish the book now.
Yeah.
Because I was about, I don't know, 3/4 of the way through the book. So it was a great honor for me to be able to talk to you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, cool. Well, I really appreciate that, Seth. That means a lot to me.
Well, again, thank you so much for doing this. And I hope people will pick up your book and enjoy it as much as I did.
Oh, thanks, Seth. Well, yeah, I really appreciate it. And yeah, I'm excited to, you know, now that I'm really more committed to digging into more science fiction. And now I have a repository of cool commentaries to check out as I work my way through any like must reads. I have been reading more Octavia Butler.
I mean, you know, lots of people would say start with stuff like Isaac Asimov's Foundation. You know, that one I wasn't a huge fan of. It depends on kind of what you like, right? If you like stuff that's funny and kind of genre bending, I recommend something like To Say Nothing of the Dog by Connie Willis, which is a comedy of manners with time travel involved.
Okay.
So that's one of my favorites. One of the most pleasant surprises. Something like Hyperion is like a super literary one because it's sort of the Canterbury Tales in space.
Oh, okay.
And obviously, you know, if you want some politics in there, Dune is the place to start.
Dune. Yeah, you know.
Especially with the movie coming out.
Yeah. And one of my regrets is when I was an undergraduate at Santa Clara, there's a political theorist there named Peter Minowitz who actually teaches a senior seminar on Dune, I think every year. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of one of these things where in those days, I was more of a kind of Supreme Court politics person. And so I did my senior seminar on that, which was great. But I, ever since then, I've kind of regretted, you know, not taking that class. But I've had, you know, of course, Professor Minowitz, you know, definitely has recommended it. And I've had a few others recommend it. So I'm going to check it out.
Yeah. But, you know, if you want to look at the list and see what hasn't been covered yet and you want to pick one, I'd be more than happy to have you.
So. Okay, cool. Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for doing this, Seth. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Keep in touch and let me know. Yeah. One of these days, maybe we could have a beer when it's safe to do so.
Yeah. Sounds good.
All right, man.
Down the road. So, all right, cool. Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Nick. I really enjoyed it. Perhaps it's a little self-indulgent for me to just do something almost completely random, but I felt like the book was important enough that I wanted to get it out there. And to talk about James Baldwin, who's someone who's influencing me right now. So in the show notes, I will put links to the resources that we've talked about today. I'll put a link, of course, to the YouTube video of the entire Baldwin versus Buckley debate. It's fantastic. If you haven't watched it, I highly recommend it. So I hope you watch that and enjoy it. I hope you got something out of this episode. Let me know if you did. And of course, I will be back to business as usual very soon. Okay, that'll do it for this time. Bye.